Very good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to On The Radar right here on Eagle FM. I'm your host, Dafa Happy Juju, bringing you the news this Wednesday, the 8th of April, 2026. Now, as the country settles back into the normal rhythm following the long weekend, many Namibians are now fully re-engaging with work, school, and businesses. Now, across the country from Windhoek to Walvis Bay, Oshakati to Ketmanshoop, the post-holiday reset is now in full swing. Roads are quieter again, and the holiday traffic surge. Offices are open, classrooms are active, and the national focus shifts back to productivity and progress. But while the holiday may be over, the conversation it sparked and the impacts it left behind are still very much relevant. And of course, let's now turn to our focus to reflect on very important aspects of social and economic areas that are affecting us and affecting our economy. As always, On The Radar is about more than just the headlines. It is about understanding the connections, how decisions in a leadership spaces translate into real life expectations for individuals, for families, and communities across Namibia. Now, in the next hour, expect sharp analysis, grounded conversation, and insights that do matter. Whether you're easing back into your workday or staying informed on the go, this right here is your space. Now, this is On The Radar on Eagle FM, not just about reporting the news, but making sense of it all. Now, let's get right into today's discussions. Namibia's Livestock and Livestock Products Board, also abbreviated as LLPBN, has taken full control of the poultry market share promotion scheme, aiming to boost the local poultry production. Now, the scheme requires importers to buy locally produced poultry before accessing import quotas, following a growth at home model. LPB acting CEO Goliath Tuyendapi says the poultry sector has shown impressive growth with increased local boiler production and new capacity coming online. The LPBN will now allocate quotas, monitor compliance, and work with industry players to ensure the scheme's success. And I quote, "We are confident that the government support producers, importers, retailers, and consumers. The scheme will accelerate our poultry industry's growth and contribute to Namibia's economic development," Tuyendapi said. Now, last year, Namibia imported about 20,380 tons of poultry meat and 474,161 livestock chicken. Let's now get hold of economist Gabriel Nginomenovari so we can understand this better and he can break it down for us on what Namibia sets to benefit from this new scheme.
Lipura nengeno wapungwa eva tere ulikoni maondu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukulile. Oshafafana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuala. Onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira.
Now to dip deeper into this news and to try and make sense of it and understand it, we have now telephonically joining us economist Nginomenovari Erastus to explain to us. Good afternoon, Nino, and welcome to On The Radar News Analysis.
Yes, good afternoon to you, ma'am.
You know, can you elaborate for our listeners the significance of this scheme that LPBN has taken on? And of course, we know it has been there, but now, obviously, it being under LPBN, how will it boost local production and perhaps also reduce imports? And maybe in the long run, increase exports.
Yeah, all right. Okay, we just have to put the things into perspective a bit. Remember, we keep talking about industrialization and self-reliance in food security and also in certain product. This conversation do not just translate into the changes that we want. It means is the actual action and the effort and the activities that we come up with that can boost the production and reduce our reliance. if you, like, I know you follow the villages and also follow the villager, we cover most of our trade statistic in terms of the gaps, in terms of the deficit, and in terms of the surplus. And almost every month, actually all every month, in terms of our merchandise account, we are always on deficit, meaning that we are spending more money on outside compared to what we spend inside. And this spending money outside, it means that we are buying product, we are buying consumable, we are buying food to feed ourselves. So now with the conversation of industrialization and improving food security and reducing dependence, certain efforts, certain activity need to be implemented. And the poultry market share promotion is one of those schemes. It has been there, but it is that it was never really, really fully utilized because it has been under the Minister of Trade and things like that. So now this scheme is now, the law has been repealed. It has now been given to the livestock board. And remember, the livestock board is the one that give a permit for import. So meaning they are standing at the statistics. They are standing and they vividly see the picture of import and export. So they understand the gap which exists in Namibia. So for them actually now to have this full mandate of implementing this is a big deal. And if they are not going even to implement it fully, then we just do not know, because they are the one who provided the statistics in terms of import. And they also understand the progress in terms of the country, in terms of the country production, in terms of import. So the importance is here that the right body have this scheme now. This body understand the production capacity. This body understand all the producers' problem. Because if you're a producer of poultry, you register yourself with them and the agronomic union, meaning they know you. So meaning there is constant engagement about what the local producers are facing. So under this scheme, when they are going to put control measures in terms of what to import and what not to import, there is practical understanding of what is on the ground. So even when they say we are going to stop you to import this product of chicken, they have an understanding. They have the statistic. So the importance is here is that now, we have a body just like agronomic when they are closing the border. We have a body that regulates the industry. We have a body that registers the producers. So the producers are able to send in their supply quantity for that particular month. And LLB is able to move to say, we cannot go to Brazil this time when our producers are having this amount of poultry product. And that is key, because what is key, what is missing now, that we have a lot of informality. We have a lot of emerging producers around the country that they can supply, but because there are no coordination, we do not know how much they are producing, it make it very difficult for us to control how much comes in. But now since we have the statistic, we have this body that has the information, it make it that it's more important, because they are able to get what is being produced on the ground and what these retailers or importers want, and they are able actually to move to say, there is a guy in Enana who is having a stock of eggs. There is a guy in somewhere in Okahanjo who has a stock of broiler chicks. Can't you go and buy from them? So is that a control measure which is data driven that you can actually create a dent? And in that aspect, you are now protecting our producer, because the producers are able to communicate their information. I have a lot of chicks. I have a lot of chicken that I've slaughtered for those who want raw supply or carcass of chicken. Do not go to Brazil. Do not go to, because we go to more than 10 countries all over the world just looking for poultry product. But we fail to document what is being produced inside, and perhaps sometimes we do not even have to go there. So that is actually what make it key in terms of boosting local production, is having the necessary insight, having access to the producers all over the country, and able to get that data and tell that importer to say, you cannot go and import because we have enough eggs. We have enough drumstick being produced somewhere there in Katima. So that is actually what is key in terms of regulating, in terms of restricting, and in terms of channeling that information to whoever need it so that they do not go and import. That is the first point about how important the scheme can boost local production.
Mm. Quite interesting. Yeah. And I do like how you explain this, Gabriel. But let's go backwards now. Let's go backwards. I think you say that, before it was under the Ministry of Trade. Now, question comes in to say, how was it being done then? So we can also still understand the magnitude of it being under LLPBN. And yes, I get it, what you're explaining, to say that, now we have tangible, evidence with the statistics to say this is what we have in our house, let's say in Namibia, so we don't need to go outside. But before, how was it actually being done? Because it clearly shows that there was something that was lacking there, that wasn't being generated or being directed in the in through the right channel.
Yeah, I don't want to be beaten, but the point is this. The point is this. For a scheme like that, it needs administrative capacity. And if you look at the mandate of LLBN, all the animal products that are being traded in Namibia, they are registered with them. So now for them to have all that mandate, they mean they understand the market very well. I'm not saying the Minister for Trade does not. It's just that they have the administrative capacity because their focus is on animal product. So, and there should be a reason why we are repealing it. That's why we repealed the law, to give them the mandate.
Mm.
So I would just end that to say that they have the administrative capacity because of specialization. They are specializing specifically on those. And every month, the statistics about animal, I mean about chicken import, come from LLBN, does not come from the Ministry of International International Relations. So
yeah,
it's a difference.
Yeah.
Because you cannot have the other guy compiling statistics of import and everything, but the guy regulating or implementing the scheme is here. So it just creates a bit of friction or let me say inefficiency in terms of administering it. So, and if the other one has the capacity to tell that we have 20 farmers who are producing broilers, so he must have also have capacity, or is actually more positioned to implement any scheme that supports broilers, because he know them, we know where they are.
Yeah.
So going back, I think that is the main, even though it took so long, because this is a 1994 act.
Yeah.
That gave the Minister of Trade and others this mandate or whatever. It's an outdated law, but we have created a body that is responsible for animal product, live and whatever. Because you will not bring a chicken in Namibia without getting a permit from them.
Mm.
You see? So it make it even more suitable for them to be able to implement this. And for me, it's just the administrative capacity and access to the farmers on the ground given the statistic that they have, which shows that they know the farmers on the ground. So that make it even more better for them to administrate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, will it be effective without other support mechanisms that can assist the local producers to scale up?
Now, that is the most important question now, because we need to understand the operating ecosystem. Because we are coming up with a lot of schemes. We are coming up with a lot of support, financial support and blah, 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 and all this. But one of the critical points that I'm observing that we are putting minimal effort is understanding the ecosystem, the operational cost of scaling up in every sector. We need to understand what does it take to fill the gap. Because remember, we are importing, last year we imported 20 tons of poultry product. And most of them are cut and whatever, deboned. And you need somebody to fill the gap. But if you look at it, we have slaughtered how many? We have slaughtered more than a million cattle. I mean, not cattle, but chicken. But it's still, we were not able to meet the demand. So there you are now given a picture of how
critical it is to scale up, to meet such a big or a huge demand.
Mm.
And that is when I'm saying that every scheme that we are coming up with, it should be supplemented by support to scale, reducing the operational cost for the farmer, for the broiler, for the chicks producer, for the layer producer. What will it take Michael Mulunga, Kadikwa, Kadila, whoever, Nangula, whoever they are, to increase the number of chicken, to increase the number of eggs, for them to set up a storage for prepared chicken, for them to start cutting and packaging them in Okongo? What does it take? And that is where we are not looking. That is when now we need supporting mechanism to support this type of scheme. Because this scheme will say, do not import, we have enough. But to arrive at enough, you need to tell your farmers, not only by telling them, you need to assist your farmers to scale up to arrive at enough. But until we are able to support the farmers, wherever they are, to scale up in terms of storing, in terms of preparing, that's why if you look at most of the posters we used to have, everybody just selling live, whatever, Herero, Swambo, Damara chicken. Everybody was selling live.
Yeah.
Then we moved from there a bit. Now we are slaughtering them. But that is it. We just slaughter them. We, whatever we do, we vava them. I don't know the word in English. We vava them or we remove the feathers. then we end it there. But if you go deeper into the statistic, what we're importing pieces of chicken, meaning cut, frozen, and packaged.
Mm.
We're importing mechanically the boned meat of chicken, meaning they removed the bone.
Mm.
So now we can use them into sausage and others and burgers. So now for a guy who is producing 200 chicken and he slaughtered them and is wanting to sell them, I don't really want a big piece of meat, which is together, bro. I want to be able to take pieces. I want to make my burger for today.
Yeah, I want to eat it again tomorrow, the next day after. Not necessarily eat a whole chicken once.
Mm. Yeah, so this person in Congo, where electricity is very expensive, where solar is expensive, where cold refrigeration storage is very expensive, they will not move to such a stage. They will not scale up to such a stage. So that's why now I'm saying that we need to complement those people to move to such a stage of value addition. And cold storage supply chain is key. Access to electricity is key. Access to water is key. But until those supportive mechanisms are available for a rural farmer, because I'm just based in outside of Kankoro. There is no electricity. And my water supply is connected to rural supply, which I cannot take certain volume. I only slaughter two when you come by, but I can actually slaughter and cut into pieces and supply Toivo ya Toivo. But you don't cut on that particular day when Toivo ya Toivo want the supply. No, you cut a week before and you put them in a frozen, so you wait.
Mm-hmm.
That is what make it easier, but I do not have cold storage here, so I cannot cut on time. So when Toivo ya Toivo come, I do not have capacity to cut, you know, so I lose. So you see, the capacity which is needed to scale up is what is missing. And that is the part that we have to concentrate on, and LLB, PBN really need to go beyond this scheme in terms of just saying stop importing or you can import, but also to subsidize certain critical component of production so that our farmers can step up. I know there are subsidies within the Minister of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
We need to expand those subsidies. We need to expand those subsidies to enable farmers and the second person to add value. That now the subsidy need to be looked at to say we are able to subsidize your acquisition of solar to come up with a 5 megawatt that you can actually power your cold storage. We are able to fund it because you told them that I have 5 schools that are willing to buy my chicken. but they need them to be cut into pieces. But when I cut into pieces, I need a cold storage truck that can transport it from Okankolo to Toivo Toivo. So the subsidy need to cover the value chain. If we want to really, really make a dent in terms of the poultry supply. So what matter is at the scaling, and we need to document what are the shortcomings faced by the guy who want to add value, faced by the farmer who want to add value. You know, because money and wealth is in the value chain, is in the value addition, not the raw material supply. A chicken which is not slaughtered, which is live, it sell at 90. But the slaughtered, the prepared one is at around 140. And the cooked one is at 200. So you see the value chain, the more we participate in the value chain, the more wealth we create. And within the value chain is where we need to scale up, and is where we need support, because the ecosystem is really making it very hard.
Interesting. Nanginamina, how would you say Namibia's livestock and livestock products board, that is LLPBN, how should they perhaps intervene to guard consumers' interests while simultaneously also ensuring that producers make a profit out of their work?
The point is this, yes. This scheme means stopping or restricting import in certain time.
Yeah.
To enable our local producers to supply the market. But yes, there are observations that have been made. We have seen the infant protection for Namibia poultry a long time ago. And we didn't see really the price changes for the consumers, but the consumer were not happy the fact that we are protecting a certain company or an industry, but the prices are not going down. So it became unfair. And that's why now I when I was listening, was not to the CEO, to the acting CEO, to say that when it's valid to intervene, we will, because it's a regulated sector. And you as and they have a mandate to protect both, not only you as a producer, but also the consumer, because this is about welfare and industrialization, of course. So he said that the scheme was tailor-made to protect both. And if there are concern observation within the market that those who have been protected from import competition are now raising prices without validity, then they will intervene, because the scheme is made to protect both consumer and the producer. And I think one of the key things is for them to have a clear approach or channel so that we consumers can take pictures. You know, I just go in a shop and like, no, why is the prices? You said we have restricted import, but look at how the price have jumped from 50 to 100 just because of import.
Yeah.
And we are able to report that to LLBN, and they are able to do the investigation that what is the cost of driving? We enabled you to access the local market. Now all of a sudden you're increasing the price. Why are you doing that? Otherwise, is it because of competition, so we open up competition, or is it really operational cost that you are facing that is pushing you to increase such prices? So I think what is key is to have an officer within LLB, because we do not have consumer protection here in Namibia until now. We only have a bill. So I think livestock board really need to move a bit forward and have a consumer relation officer for this specific scheme, so that when this scheme get to be implemented fully, when the producers are protected, the same thing, the consumers, we also need to benefit. Because remember, government is to a certain extent subsidizing this. Government is literally creating a market for them to benefit. And when it comes to welfare economics, so that welfare share, it needs to be shared between the producers and the consumer.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I really like your thinking capacity. You know, you're going as far as where I didn't obviously think, but you're the economist, so you need to take, you're taking credit because you're the economist. Not so? Anyway, you spoke about...
Thank you also for pushing my curiosity, yes.
Yes. Now, you know, you spoke about we don't have a consumer's protection bill. I think it's something like that, right?
Yeah, a consumer protection law. If you face anything here in Namibia, there is nowhere to go report, really. Like specific for you.
Now, what about Namibia Commission competition? Namibia competition, I think it's so, right?
Yeah, those one are mostly on competition, economy competition or peer-to-peer competition between companies.
Yeah.
Look, this mandate is within the Minister of Industrialization, Minister of Trade before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know now whether that is going to international relation or it went to industrialization meme. And there was a draft policy on it. And let me give a classical example. This infant milk that were stopped in South Africa, in Namibia were able to come.
Yeah.
And it's because we do not have such a dedicated department that is supposed to be busy doing research to protect the consumer interest. We do not have that. Mm-hmm. A body or a department that look after consumer interest to take action. Even if you go to a shop now and you find something expired, it's actually the municipality within their bylaw who intervene. There is no department that can go there. So you see there is such a gap. Or consumer protection in Namibia is not actually a priority, but we are having a lot of issues from companies or from producers.
Mm-hmm.
When you go in a shop and something is damaged or whatever, you have no law. You go to the Chinese shop there in Northern Industry, they will tell you like no return.
Mm.
You see? And if they are doing that because there is a gap in the legislature, they know there is no provision that can prosecute them for whatever they do to the consumer.
I see.
And even if prices are increased without any economic reasoning, especially in terms of operational, nobody will report. Nobody will report. Except maybe within the petroleum sector. The Minister of Mine is able to say you guys will not hold fuel because they are a regulator. Or the quality of fuel because they are a regulator. In terms of the quality of fuel, we can report to the Minister of Mine because there are certain standards.
Yeah.
But for other products, you can be actually mistreated, consume bad the product. There are no specific department or line or law that you can use actually to protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that vagueness and the sluggishness to come up with a policy and to come up with a law that protects consumers' interest.
Mm. Yeah. Quite interesting.
Mm.
Yeah. And what do you think, which department or perhaps which ministry should now look at this and or perhaps can also parastatals come in to make their suggestions so that they can get up and running to protect the consumers? And something also which might look insignificant that's coming to my mind as you're speaking is that you go in a shop and they say this bread is 10 Namibian dollars and only to get to the till and it's 25 Namibian dollars and they get away with that. And you go home and come back and yeah.
Yeah, and they tell you that no, we changed the price yesterday, but we forgot to put the sign.
Mm.
That is not my problem. You see, it's because the consumers, nobody give about consumers, really, a foot about consumers.
Yeah.
Because it's wrong for you to tell me that the price is $2 and when I go to the tiller, it's $10. Then you tell me, no, you just forgot to remove the thing.
And mind
no,
you,
I
went
already
home.
Priced it in, you know.
It took my cab money to come and address this issue.
Yeah, so it's the ideology in economic building that it mostly focuses on producers and entrepreneurs. They are given a priority in terms of everything, that they are the most important people.
Yeah.
But when you come to a consumer, you are literally nobody. That is now in terms of economic literature. And in Namibia and also in Africa, that is what we follow because our capitalistic friends, that is what they tell us, that protect the investor. So it led to this type of chaosness within the consumer protection regime that consumers are taking. That's why until now, look how old we are. We do not have a specific law that protects the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Only in terms of health. In terms of health, you have your different bodies in terms of the pharmaceutical product,
yeah,
in terms of standard,
HPCNE,
and in terms of petroleum. But overall, you as a consumer, when you are disadvantaged at the economic level, at the commercial level, nobody really. And that's why within the insurance industry and within other police industry, consumers were taken for advantage because nobody was explaining the terms of the police. And when something happened, then they tell you, no, this is part of your contract. But they were not explaining these things clearly because there's nothing was to force. There was nothing forcing them Only now we are including some of those provisions within FEMA, that all insurance, all policyholders, insurance and medical aid, make sure you explain in the lame or basic language to the holder or to a person who wants to buy a certain policy, so that they know. Unlike before, you just sign things that you do not understand because nobody really care about you as a client. They're only protecting their interest. So we used to call it information asymmetry. So it's because of the gap which was within the legislative framework.
Interesting. I learned something, and of course the listeners have learned something too. Gabriel, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reading News Analysis. We do really always appreciate your sentiments and your wisdom and insight.
All right, ma'am. Welcome.
Okay. And there we had it from economist Gabriel Nginamenavari Erastus. Now, be on the lookout for Friday's e-paper, The Villager, because I'm definitely sure this will be covered in The Villager e-paper. Now, if you still want to learn more regarding this, please head over to our WhatsApp channel. All you have to do is send a text message to 081. That is a WhatsApp text message to 081-200-4144. Head over there and learn up on social economic news. Today's e-paper is out since it is Wednesday. Friday's one is coming out 2 days from now, or let's say a day from now. Now, let's pause right here. Take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly. Do stay tuned. 083-288-401 is the number in studio. Should you want to ask a question or your contributions right here on the Radar News Analysis.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Welcome back, and now let's get into economic indicators before we move over to news beyond the borders of Namibia. Now, US dollar today is equals to 16.41 Namibian dollars, and one Australian dollar is equals to 11 Namibian dollars 0.57 cents. One United Arab Emirates dirham is equals to 4 Namibian dollars 0.47 cents. 1 euro is equals to 19 Namibian dollars 0.19 cents. 1 pound sterling is equals to 22 Namibian dollars 0.09 cents. And 1 Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 22 cents. Let's now move over to news beyond the borders of Namibia. Let's start off in South Africa, where President Cyril Ramaphosa has received letters of credence from the heads of mission designate.
And I'm focusing on the positive, as I told the president, President Ramaphosa, that this is the art of the possible that we have to look at. There are those who want to sow discord between our two countries. I understand that. I'm not one of them. I'm one who's trying to find solutions.
Ambassador, obviously, your fleeting reaction to the developments in the Middle East, you're here representing President Trump, a very concerning conflict for the global economy. Just your reaction to the ceasefire.
Well, I think it's a good thing. Any ceasefire that both countries can agree to is a good thing. I think that it's provisional in the sense that Iran has to abide by it. The concern is always going to be its proxies and what they might do. I hope that's not going to be the case. I hope that in the days that come, they're going to find a final solution to this conflict. And we can go back to where we were before when Iran wasn't threatening its neighbors. And there was peace and there was prosperity.
And just once again, Ambassador, the issue of trade between the U.S. and South Africa, the tariffs, a great deal of concern. Are you hoping to ease that particular route to, for example, make sure that AGOA is sustained among other trade instruments?
Yeah. Look, there are serious issues between our two nations that have to be resolved. But I can tell you this, I've already expressed it to your government, which is the United States is ready to pour money into investments in South Africa. And it's not just the private sector that's doing it, but the government that is doing it. There are billions upon billions of dollars that we want to invest in this country. But there are issues that we have, and the primary one is the respect for private property. It's very difficult for a country to come in here, I'm sorry, a major corporation to come here and be told it has to surrender 30% of its ownership or some such thing. Now, having said that, it's also my belief, and I've been very outspoken on this, South Africa is a different country in the sense that you came out of suffering and you came out of a very unequal system where you had nothing. Blacks had nothing in this country. As such, I think corporations that come here have an ethical duty, a moral duty, to invest more than just capital into your country, but to invest in the future of your country. I'm all in favor of that.
Ambassador, disrespectfully, one of the things the president said was to respect the sovereignty of the country that you're in. So you're coming to serve in South Africa. It has specific laws. What are you going to take back to your president in the United States about South Africa and the way it's conducting its business and the respect of the rule of law for South Africa in terms of the way America interacts with this country?
Well, look, the United States doesn't question anything that South Africa does insofar as its sovereignty. South Africa may do anything it wishes to do. However, we would say, as any nation on the planet would say, that if any policy ever goes against our national interests or goes against our national security concerns, that's when we speak up. So we will be outspoken on those two levels. At the same time, as I told the president, it's an extraordinary feat that really hasn't gotten the recognition it deserves, that your president was the primary author of a constitution where he went to our constitution to understand how to write his. We have shared values. Do we have differences? Of course we do. That's okay. Are there shared values? Yes. Are there shared interests? Yes. So I come here looking at the art of the possible. How can you build on those things? If we want to be contentious, sure, we could be contentious. If we want to throw, verbal hand grenades, sure, we could do that. But that's not the goal. The goal is to build a new relationship.
Ambassador, you really had a bumpy start. You had to be summoned to the Department of International Relations and Cooperation over your remarks. Do you regret uttering those remarks? And really just, is there any change of posture in terms of respecting that South Africa, there must be redress given the very turbulent past that we have? You went to the Apartheid Museum, you went to District 6, among many other landmarks that you've been to in the country.
Yeah, and I'm going to be visiting others. in the days to come. And I'm going to go with some of the most influential and well-known men that this country has to continue that voyage. Now, as to that speech, I will simply say to anyone, read the speech and listen to the remarks. It was 100% positive. It was, as I've said, it was 95% positive, 5% hopeful. It was delivered that way. There was one question that was asked about the kill the boar issue. Look, the position of my country is that that's wrong, that is hate speech. The position of the civilized world is that that's hate speech. I have nothing but respect for the judiciary in South Africa. As a matter of fact, I'll point out that with all due respect to the other forms of government, it is the one area that is most respected, I believe, in South Africa. From the conversations I've had, the greatest respect is for the judiciary. I take nothing away from that. I will say that that judges can be wrong. American judges are wrong all the time. It doesn't mean I have no respect for the judiciary system. I've got complete respect for the American judiciary system. So I've done that. Some people chose to say things afterwards. I read in your media, and some of you folks were responsible for this, some of the most extraordinary things I never said. And some of the most extraordinary beliefs I've never held. I understand that. You know, politics sometimes is hardball. But look, get beyond that. Look at the substance of everything I've said about your country. Then you'll understand where I am.
Right. Do you think your tenure here will actually improve the relations between South Africa and the United States, or are we going to see a further breakdown?
Do you know, if I didn't, I wouldn't be here. If I didn't, I wouldn't have accepted the assignment. Now, we all understand that the word that's used all the time is frail to describe the relationships between these countries. Okay, that's fine. If I thought that it couldn't be resolved, these issues couldn't be resolved, I would have retired. I told President Trump I wanted to retire. He said, no, you got to do this. He also believes that we can turn our situation around. And not only that, but build a new partnership based on shared values, based on shared self-interest that we have, both of our countries. I've been making this statement everywhere I go, that we are a country that believes that we should be America first. We are coming to you as America first. And we have exceptionalism that we project without apologies. At the same time, I want South Africa to return, to respond with South Africa first, with South African exceptionalism. Because when you do that, then there's mutual respect. And when there's mutual respect, that's where understandings begin. And where understandings begin, new partnerships evolve. And that's where we want to go. So the question is, absolutely, I believe something can happen. I wouldn't be here if I didn't.
Where are you going to start, Ambassador?
Meanwhile, on World Health Day yesterday, South Africa received its first batch of Lenacapavir, according to Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi. Let's take a listen to that.
Today is World Health Day, and the World Health Organization says while there are many challenges, this day must also be used to stand with science and also celebrate some achievements. Now, the Department of Health here at home saying it is using this day to highlight some critical health issues, promoting health equity. Now, it comes as the country has received the first batch of Lenacapavir, which is a huge milestone for the fight against HIV in the country. Health Minister Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi joins us live now from France to discuss the significance of this. Minister, good evening to you, and thank you so much for your time. So we are marking World Health Day at a time when South Africa has now received the first batch of Lenacapavir. What does this mean for the country as far as the fight against HIV is concerned?
Good evening, Bongiwe. Good evening to the listeners and viewers out there. Indeed, we have already said last year that Lenacapavir is a game changer. And the fact that it has now arrived in the country on Thursday last week is a big milestone for us. It shows that the dream is coming true.
And when you speak about the dream coming true, though, someone watching us tonight is asking themselves, how soon can they get it?
Yeah, is going to be launched officially, Bongiwe, by the president himself. We want him to do a national launch so that the whole country can know that Lenacapavir has been launched. On the day of launching, it will be available in 350 selected health facilities in the country, in the very high burden districts. So we'll be able to tell people that, we'll be able to release a list and say these are the clinics who have got Lenacapavir, so that people don't run all over the place.
So when then, you know, I was looking at your statement earlier on as the department when it comes to World Health Day, you were speaking about the issues of access, right, and equity and making sure that people do have access, you know, to healthcare facilities. But when I bring that conversation to Lenacapavir, for example, there are many other factors and that might be looked at when it comes to the success of it. I'm thinking finances, for example. How then do you tackle that particular issue? Because you did say in the past that it is expensive.
Yes, Bongiwe, it is very expensive. Remember that Lenacapavir is already there in the U.S. It sells for $28,000, not rands, $28,000, which means it's more than 450 South African rands. That is absolutely unaffordable for the African continent. What then happened is that the Global Fund moved in and secured 2 million doses. Out of each, South Africa is going to get more than 900,000 doses. But then you'll ask, what happens when the 900 doses have been exhausted? In September last year, during UNGA, United Nations General Assembly, two things happened, which are the same. One of them is that the Clinton Health Access Initiative, together with UNITAID, together with VETS RHI and us in South Africa, came together to support a pharmaceutical company called Dr. Reddy's, who is going to manufacture a generic. And that generic is going to be manufactured for as low as $40. Maybe I need to explain what does that mean. How did that happen, Bongiwe? Ordinarily, under global rules, when a pharmaceutical company has come up with a new drug, they've got 20 years intellectual property rights over that medicine, and they can sell it at the price of their choice to recoup the cost for producing it and researching it. But now, this company that has produced Lenacapavir called Gilead, were told by many people around the world that the world cannot wait for 20 years. It's impossible. Even though the law says so, it's impossible. They must do something. So they were pressurized to give what you call voluntary licenses. In other words, any company doesn't have to wait for 20 years before they manufacture a generic of the same drug at a very reduced cost. But still, they needed to be subsidized. That's where the Clinton Health Access Initiative came in, to subsidize Dr. Reddy's, because they are one of the six companies that has received a voluntary licensing.
Yeah. So are you prioritizing any, you know, group among the populations in South Africa here, as far as the jabs are concerned?
Indeed, we are. We are, Bongiwe. We didn't just guess. You may remember that last year we did invite the media in a very big meeting, which we called a round table, where we called all the 18 sectors of SANAC, civil society, researchers, academics, traditional healers, traditional leaders, government, business, together with development partners, including the World Health Organization, UNAIDS, etc., etc. They all came together to discuss which group of vulnerable people should we prioritize if we are to break the back of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And we identified four groups. Number one is adolescent girls and young women. Number two is lactating women and, pregnant women. That number two. Number three is lactating women, women who are breastfeeding. And number four is bridging populations like sex workers and men having sex with men. Those are the groups that we have prioritized.
So let's then talk about something else just before I let you go, because when we talk about equity in this country, we can't have that conversation without speaking about the NHI Act, for example, and what is currently taking place. So the medical brief reporting that you've met with the South African Medical Association, is that the case? And if it is so, which other organizations are you planning to meet with regarding this?
Oh, I've met with the SAMIS to discuss this issue. We will meet with any organization that wish to meet with us or that we wish to meet with to discuss the health care of the country, because the health care of the country can't be run by any one sector successfully. It needs collaboration. So yes, we need to collaborate with as many organizations as possible. Our doors are open to meet anybody.
Mm. So what happens then to the court action while these meetings are taking place? Does it affect it at all?
Oh, you mean the action against NHI?
Yes.
No. Remember what happened early this year, Bonkiwe, that there are 15 court cases. Mm. There was a court case in the Constitutional Court, which was supposed to happen on the 26th of February. And there was another case in the High Court, which was supposed to take place between the 24th and the 27th of February. But while those cases were set up, something completely new happens. The BHF, Board of Healthcare Funders, went to litigate not against the substance of NHI, but the process which Parliament followed to pass NHI Act.
Mm-hmm.
And then another case is the government of Western Cape went to challenge NCOP also about the process.
Mm.
The Chief Justice then ruled that it will be foolhardy to continue with these cases when the whole process is being challenged.
Yeah.
Let's now switch over to international news, where Iran and U.S. have agreed on conditional 2-week ceasefire and the opening of the Strait of Hormuz.
Both the U.S. and Iran say they've agreed to a 2-week ceasefire, as I've been saying. Just to reiterate that, U.S. President Donald Trump said he is suspending his latest deadline for Iran to strike a deal or face U.S. military escalation. The president wrote on Truth Social that after a conversation with the Pakistani Prime Minister, who proposed the deal subject to the Islamic Republic of Iran agreeing to the complete, immediate and safe opening of the Strait of Hormuz, I agree to suspend the bombing and attack of Iran for a period of 2 weeks. This will be a double-sided ceasefire. Iranian state media claims the U.S. has agreed to their 10-point peace plan that includes complete and permanent end to the war, reopening the Strait of Hormuz, compensation and reconstruction payments to Iran, full commitment to lifting of sanctions on Iran. Iran fully commits to not seeking possession of any nuclear weapons was something that the U.S. had demanded of Iran. This, as we've been saying, is a rapidly developing story, and we are still picking up more reactions, getting you the latest now from Pakistan's Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, who's just put out a post on X. And this is what it says: with great humility, I am pleased to announce that the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States of America, along with their allies, have agreed to an immediate ceasefire everywhere, including Lebanon and elsewhere, effective immediately. I warmly welcome the sagacious gesture and I extend deepest gratitude to the leadership of both countries and invite their delegations to Islamabad on Friday, 10th April 2026, to further negotiate for a conclusive agreement to settle all disputes. Both parties have displayed remarkable wisdom and understanding and have remained constructively engaged in furthering the cause of peace and stability. We earnestly hope that the Islamabad talks succeed in achieving sustainable peace and wish to share more good news in the coming days. That is from the Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif. Remember, Pakistan has positioned itself as a crucial mediator in these conversations. For more, let's go across to Hashyar Junaidi, our Washington correspondent for BBC Persian. Hashyar, good to have you once again. Before we get into what we are likely to see, what more are you picking up from from Iran, from Tehran, as far as their official reaction?
Well, the government and state media are portraying this as a big victory for the regime. A statement put out by the Supreme National Security Council of Iran says that Iran has reached almost all of its objectives in this war. The enemy is facing a historic failure. And then refers that Iran had put out a 10-point peace plan that the U.S. has accepted. Of course, they're going to negotiate about this. This is what the Iranians are arguing, that the Iran will have a control over the traffic in the Hormuz Strait. There will be a ceasefire, total ceasefire, regarding all of the fighting between Israel and Iran's proxies. The U.S. should leave all bases in the region, and compensation should be paid to Iran. And of course, the Iranian media are also adding that part of that 10-point deal is lifting of all sanctions and ending of all hostilities. The Supreme National Security Council says that amid a lack of trust on the American side and the Iranian side, mutual trust, talks will start resuming Islamabad, Pakistan from Friday, and it's going to be for 2 weeks. And they've said that if the talks are successful, the two-week ceasefire could be extended. But one other thing. This is amid this statement and this posing that we are the victor. There is another point that is very important for the Iranian government. This war started with the killing of Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic, and senior generals within the IRGC. This was an existential threat, existential war for the regime. Therefore, they would consider themselves victorious because they survived this 30-plus days of war with the United States and Israel.
Khoshar, I want to go back to some of those points that you mentioned, the 10-point plan. You know, Iran has been categorical in its demands, but a lot of those points that they have talked about have been unacceptable to the U.S. in the past. How difficult or complex are these conversations going to be in Pakistan for both sides to find common ground to agree, given that they are also operating in an environment of a serious trust deficit?
Well, that's true. That's true. There's a deficit of trust. Iran and the U.S. have negotiated twice in the past year, and both times in the middle of negotiations a war has started. And the demands of Iran, no matter how victorious they're portraying themselves in state media, Iran is in a very weak position. Its army has been heavily battered. Its economy is in shambles. The regime has an unfinished business with the opposition and the people. The government has started executing some of those people who were arrested during the protests in January in the past few days, and we've had one or two executions every day. So the regime at the same time has to harden its grip on power inside the country as well. It's in a bad situation, but at the same time, Its demands are difficult for the Americans to address. The U.S.
And with that, we now cross over and hand over to Lois Ishimi, who is in Anangwa Studios. Stay tuned for that.
Lipura nengeno wapungwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukulile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuana. Onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitida mo Eagle FM otuna evi totae njuka. Okupitida oipindi konu konda beli nawa.
That this address would be presided by such a profound grief. Comrade James Onomasa Kwerikwa and his son, Veturo, tragically passed on in a car accident on the 3rd April 2026, leaving their family to bear an unimaginable loss. We wish those still hospitalized a swift and full recovery. The loss of Comrade Werukwa It's a loss to his family, to the National Assembly, the SWAPO Party, and indeed the Namibian nation. He embodied Namibia's hope and stood firm for unity in this chamber. We are deeply pained by his passing and should commit to honoring his legacy in this august house. I now kindly ask that we rise to observe a minute of silence in their honor.